Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we are undertaking a deep dive into the kind of source material that truly earns its weekend edition title. We're looking at the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, December 27th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Astor. And you are absolutely right about that. The sheer breadth of what we've got in front of us today is just extraordinary. We're going from, you know, active military strikes and high-stakes peace deals all the way to massive waste in our own healthcare system.
And even a $240 million windfall for employees in a small American town, it's a huge range.
It really is.
And that's why this deep dive is so important. For you, the listener, our mission is to, you know, synthesize this massive volume of information. We're going to go beyond the headlines, try to extract the core insights, and really connect the dots across geopolitics, domestic policy, and the marketplace.
Yeah, to give you that thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive report so you can walk away really understanding the impact and, you know, the implications of all these moving parts.
Exactly. So let's jump right in, starting with a very volatile landscape of global flashpoints.
We have to start with a pretty significant military action that took place, of all days, on Christmas Day. President Trump ordered missile strikes targeting two alleged Islamic State camps deep inside Nigeria.
Okay, and these weren't drones. These were fired from a U.S. Navy warship, right, in the Gulf of Guinea.
That's right, fired from a warship. The strikes reportedly killed multiple militants, and it really marks a major escalation of U.S. involvement in that region's conflicts.
And the justification given, at least back home, was framed in a very specific way.
Extremely specific. U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, said the strikes were based on joint intelligence with Nigerian forces. But the administration and the president himself explicitly tied this action to protecting Nigeria's Christian population.
The president had previously used the word genocide to describe the violence against Christians there.
He did. And then Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posts this message online, just more to come.
Yeah.
It's all signaling that these strikes were, you know, designed to protect Christians, which is a message that clearly resonates with a key U.S. political base.
But this is where the simple narrative starts to fall apart when it hits the ground in Nigeria, doesn't it?
It completely does. Nigerian authorities pushed back almost immediately. They disputed this whole idea that the conflict is purely religious, calling the U.S. characterization a, and I'm quoting here, gross misrepresentation of the reality.
Their point being that the violence targets everyone, Muslims and Christians alike.
Exactly. And that nuance is just crucial to understanding what's really happening. Nigeria's conflict landscape is incredibly fractured. You've got ISIS and Boko Haram in the northeast, sure. But this strike was in the northwest, a region that's predominantly Muslim and is just plagued by what they call bandits.
And these bandits are a different kind of threat, less ideological, more criminal enterprise.
Precisely. They're officially designated terrorists by Nigeria, but they specialize in abducting people, churchgoers, school children for ransom. It blurs the line between ideology and organized crime. And that's not even getting into the brutal conflicts in the central region between farmers and herdsmen over land.
So if that's the reality on the ground, what is the actual tactical effect of a U.S. missile strike on an alleged ISIS camp? I mean, is it just symbolic if these groups are so mobile?
That's the million-dollar question. And analysts on the ground, like Chidi Nwanu, say these forces are so lightly armed and mobile that airstrikes have a very limited effect. Unless you immediately follow up with coordinated, sustained ground action, they just scatter. They hide their weapons, they move, and they regroup somewhere else.
So the implication here seems to be more political than military.
I think that's fair to say. The move looks designed to satisfy a domestic base in the U.S., while the actual effectiveness on the ground remains highly questionable without a much bigger, longer-term strategy.
A strong signal with a limited military punch. Okay, let's move from that military action to some intense political maneuvering. The road to peace between Ukraine and Russia seems to be accelerating pretty dramatically.
It really is. We have Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky planning a huge meeting with President Trump in Florida this Sunday. The goal is to iron out the final details of a 20-point draft deal to end the war.
And this draft is significant because it's not just a Ukrainian proposal. It was drafted by Trump's own envoys with Russian input, correct?
That's the key. Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner authored it, and they reportedly incorporated Russian feedback during the drafting process. This is a U.S. brokered framework.
And it seems Ukraine is prepared to put a massive concession on the table, something they've resisted for, well, for years.
A huge one. They are now apparently willing to cede some of the land they currently hold in eastern Donetsk. This would be part of a new demilitarized front line, It's an enormous political risk for Zelensky.
Because their constitution explicitly forbids surrendering territory. How would they even manage that politically?
The only way they could is by putting it to a national referendum. That's the condition. The Ukrainian people would have to approve it. The idea is that both sides would pull back, creating a sort of demilitarized free economic zone in that contested area.
Okay, so what's the quid pro quo? What does Ukraine get in return for giving up fortified land and taking that kind of political heat?
Their absolute non-negotiable demand is for explicit, congressionally approved security guarantees from the United States. They want something that functions just like NATO's Article 5.
The Collective Defense Clause, an attack on one is an attack on all.
Exactly. And the emphasis is on congressionally approved. They know that without Congress voting to back it up, any guarantee from a president is just, you know, window dressing. Putin would test it eventually, just like he ignored the Minsk Accords.
So the sticking points are still the future of that land, the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, and the precise legal weight of those U.S. guarantees.
Those are the big three. And we also have to ask, what's Russia's real take on all this?
Right. What are they saying publicly?
Publicly, they're being, let's say, ambivalent. Russia's deputy foreign minister said the Kremlin's plan differs, quote, significantly from what Ukraine is pushing. But what's more interesting is the economic side of the deal.
The idea being pushed by Trump's team that a post-sanctions Russia will be a land of opportunity for U.S. investors.
Yes, a land of vast natural resources and rich business opportunities. But veterans of the Russian economy are, to put it mildly, deeply skeptical.
Skeptical even if all the sanctions were lifted tomorrow. Why?
Because the structural problems run so much deeper than sanctions. They're warning U.S. business not to view Russia as some kind of emerald city. You're looking at an economy with weak long-term growth, a shrinking population, and this is critical, rapidly declining easily extracted oil reserves.
Meaning the cost and risk of getting the rest of it out of the ground is going to skyrocket.
Precisely. By 2030, they expect 80% of their oil reserves to be hard to recover. That requires massive long-term capital investment, and that's just the geology. The bigger problem is the politics.
The rule of law, or the lack thereof?
There is no rule of law. The risk of asset seizure is the number one deterrent for any serious investor. Moscow has seized over $49 billion in assets since the invasion, just handing them over to Putin's loyalists.
So the message from people who have actually worked there is, why would you invest for decades in an Arctic energy project when the state can just take it from you tomorrow?
Exactly. They say Putin only honors his word to the specific person he gives it to. That kind of instability makes the whole land of bounty narrative feel incredibly fragile. It's a tough sell.
A very tough sell.
Yeah.
Okay, speaking of nations testing U.S. commitments, let's pivot to the escalating tensions between China and Taiwan.
A very direct response from Beijing. They've imposed sanctions on 20 U.S. defense companies and 10 executives. This came right after the Trump administration approved an $11.1 billion weapons package for Taiwan.
And that package included some serious hardware, right? Like HIMARS missile launchers.
HIMARS, howitzers, yeah, crucial long-range systems. So Beijing hit back, sanctioning big names like Northrop Grumman and Boeing's defense unit in St. Louis.
And they also targeted a specific executive, Palmer Luckey, the founder of Anduril. That seems pointed.
Very pointed. Anduril is a company focused specifically on developing tech for potential future conflicts with China. So, yes, a clear message there. The sanctions themselves freeze any assets they have in China and ban the executives from entering.
But practically speaking, these defense contractors don't really do business in China. So the immediate economic impact is more symbolic, isn't it?
You're right. It's largely symbolic on the money front, but the political message is anything but. Beijing's foreign ministry was clear. They see the weapons sale as interfering in their internal affairs and undermining their sovereignty. These sanctions are about underscoring that territorial claim and keeping the pressure on Washington.
Okay, let's shift our gaze to another flashpoint, this time between two supposed U.S. allies in the Gulf. Tensions are rising between Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
And this is a major headache for U.S. foreign policy. The latest event was Saudi warplanes actually striking a UAE-backed Yemeni militia. The group is called the Southern Transitional Council, or STC. They're a powerful separatist group armed by the UAE.
So why would Saudi Arabia strike their own ally's proxy force?
Because that proxy force, the STC, was making major territorial gains in oil-rich areas right near the Saudi border. The strikes were seen as a direct warning shot, basically telling them to back off.
And this isn't just about Yemen, is it? These two countries are backing rival factions in Sudan as well.
Exactly. This isn't a one-off. It's a pattern of proxy conflicts between the two key pillars of the Trump administration's Middle East policy. It completely fragments that unified front the U.S. wants to maintain against Iran. It just injects a whole new layer of instability into the region.
Before we leave geopolitics, we have a fascinating story on the other side of global finance. The hunt for a North Korean mastermind who is basically an expert at undermining global sanctions.
Sim Hyung-onsop. He's 42 years old, a North Korean financier, and he's at the top of the FBI's most wanted list for this kind of activity. He runs a highly sophisticated money laundering and sanctions evasion network for the Kim Jong-un regime.
And his methods are incredibly creative. We're not just talking about bank transfers.
Oh, no. It's much more complex. Prosecutors say he routes funds to buy all sorts of things, communication equipment, even a helicopter. He also gets into low-tech, high-profit crime. He allegedly paid $800,000 in cash for tobacco, which North Korea then uses to make counterfeit cigarettes to sell across Asia.
But the real money, the seed capital for all this, comes from stolen cryptocurrency.
That's the engine. The regime has netted over $6 billion from cyber theft over the years, and the source gives us a perfect example of how Sim's crypto laundromat actually works.
Okay, walk us through it.
All right, so a U.S. crypto developer pays $216,000 in crypto to a coder he thinks is in Singapore. That money goes to a digital wallet controlled by Sim.
And from there, it gets mixed with other stolen funds.
Right. Then it's transferred to the wallet of a sanctioned over-the-counter trader in the UAE.
Wait. Stop there. Why the UAE? Why an OTC trader?
Because they specialize in turning large amounts of crypto into regular currency, like US dollars, without going through the usual banking checkpoints. It's a key step for laundering. So the UAE trader converts it to dollars, deposits it into a Hong Kong front company's account, and from there, the money is used to pay for communication devices in Thailand.
Wow. So it goes from stolen US crypto to a coder, to a wallet, to the UAE, to Hong Kong, and finally to physical goods for the regime.
A multi-layered camouflage operation. And the most shocking part is how major banks were completely fooled by this. We're talking Citibank, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, HSBC.
How could they miss it?
The indictment says they unknowingly processed at least 310 transactions worth about $74 million for Pyongyang. Sim's network is just world-class at using shell companies and layers of transfers to hide money's origin. It shows just how sophisticated North Korea has become at exploiting the very global financial system they're meant to be cut off from.
That is just staggering. Okay, let's pivot from that global chaos and bring it home to the domestic front. We're going to look at some deep systemic problems in healthcare and the very personal reality of the economic struggle in America.
And we have to start with a massive systemic flaw in U.S. healthcare. Specifically, the cost of overprescribing medications through Medicare. A Wall Street Journal analysis found it cost taxpayers and patients $3 billion in just 3 years.
$3 billion in waste. And that's not because the drugs don't work, it's because of how they're being dispensed. So let's unpack that. Who is driving this and how is it happening?
The main culprit, by a long shot, is mail order pharmacies. Now, they only filled about 9% of Medicare prescriptions in that period, but they accounted for 37% of the excessive dispensing.
So they are wildly overrepresented in the waste. And these are the giant pharmacies owned by the big healthcare conglomerates, right?
Exactly. UnitedHealth, Humana, CVS Health. Their business model often involves automatically sending out 90-day refills, frequently well before the patient actually needs them.
It's an automated system overriding actual patient need. Do the data point to any specific offenders?
It does, very clearly. UnitedHealth's mail order pharmacies were the worst by a pretty wide margin. They sent refills too early 11% of the time. That's almost 9 times the rate of other pharmacies. In dollar terms, UnitedHealth wasted about $142 in excess medication per recipient. They were number one on the list.
And beyond the outrageous cost, this has to create serious safety risks, especially for elderly patients.
Oh, the safety risk is acute. You've got seniors who might be dealing with memory issues or complex drug schedules. Doctors talk about finding shoeboxes and drawers just overflowing with unneeded pills.
And if you have that many extra pills lying around,
you might accidentally double a dose. Or you might keep taking an old dosage your doctor already changed. The analysis found that muscle relaxants and antipsychotics, like Seroquel, were frequently in that over-refilled pile. It's dangerous.
Which brings us to the core question. Why? Why do these massive companies allow and even seem to encourage this kind of wasteful and dangerous practice?
It's a perfect storm of perverse incentives. First, pharmacies make money from dispensing fees and markups. So more pills out the door means more profit. Simple as that. Second, since the insurers own the pharmacies, they can shift revenue to their less regulated pharmacy side.
And there's a third reason related to their quality ratings.
Right. High adherence to prescriptions, which, you know, automated refills, it definitely helps with, can boost a health plan's quality ratings from Medicare. And better ratings mean more federal money. So they're gaming the system for profit, for revenue, and for ratings, all at the expense of patients and taxpayers.
That is just deeply, deeply troubling. Speaking of systemic failures, let's turn to another crisis in healthcare access, the so-called ghost network crisis in mental health.
This is a really growing area of litigation. You have patients suing their insurance companies because their plans promise great mental health coverage. But when they try to find a provider, the network is, as I say, virtually non-existent. The directories are full of providers who aren't there. The ghost network.
That sounds terrifying for someone in a crisis. Give us a real-world example of what that looks like for a patient.
Okay, take Joe Green, a real estate broker in New York. His psychiatrist retired. He spent months calling dozens of names from his insurer's list to get his anxiety and depression meds. He found doctors who weren't in the network, weren't taking new patients, or whose phone numbers were just disconnected. He eventually gave up and had to pay $50,000 out of network over a couple of years just to continue his care.
$50,000. And I imagine many people can't afford that and just fall through the cracks.
Many do. There's another case of a mother with an autistic toddler who needs intensive therapy. She couldn't find a single in-network provider and now faces bills up to $20,000 a month.
So why is this gap so much worse for mental health than for, say, a knee surgeon?
It comes down to economics. Insurers simply pay mental health specialists less than they pay for medical or surgical care. So especially in big cities, many therapists find they don't need to take insurance at all. They can run a successful practice just with cash-paying clients, which leaves the network barren.
And the lawsuits trying to fix this are running into legal hurdles.
They are. The hardest part for lawyers is trying to quantify the damages for the people who are hurt the most. I mean, how do you put a dollar figure on the harm done to someone who gets so frustrated that they just give up on finding care altogether? That's the challenge.
A challenge that perfectly humanizes an administrative failure. Let's shift now to a deeply personal story that illustrates the bruising reality for an unlucky job seeker. Let's talk about Lynn Lee.
Lynn Lee is a 65-year-old woman in Kershaw, South Carolina. She was just laid off from a soybean plant. This was her fourth layoff in her life, and the timing is just brutal.
Because she's nearing retirement but can't afford to stop working.
Not at all. She has $7,000 in medical debt from battling breast cancer and a heart issue, plus a $42,000 second mortgage on her home. She has to work.
And her personal story really tracks the deindustrialization of that part of America.
It's a perfect microcosm. She worked for 29 years at a local textile plant, Springs Industries, until they moved operations to Brazil in 2007. And after that layoff, she showed incredible resilience. She went back to school and earned an associate's degree. Her final paper, very fittingly, was on the expendability of the American worker.
And now she's facing that expendability again in a very tough market for older workers.
A very tough market. Nearly a quarter of unemployed people have been out of work for more than 6 months. She applied for a couple of local jobs, an HR gig, a clerical job at a gold mine, but was rejected for both. And all the while, the clock is ticking on her $270 weekly unemployment check, which only lasts for 5 months in South Carolina.
So what did she have to do just to get by?
She had to start going to a food pantry for basics. After her unemployment ran out, she had to call her mortgage company, and they thankfully agreed to pause her payments until February. She did find a temporary job, but then she had a minor fall at work, and that job ended quickly too. It's just one setback after another.
It's just a brutal sequence of events. It really shows how fragile the safety net is.
It really does. But the story ends on her resilience. Her community is stepping up to help, and she's still determined. She says, "Something is going to break for me. It has to." Her struggle just puts a very real human face on the abstract economic numbers we talk about all the time.
It certainly does. Okay, let's transition from that personal struggle to the heart of Washington, D.C. itself. We're seeing some interesting political shifts and getting a look at the real power players behind the scenes.
We're definitely seeing a tactical shift among centrist Democrats. They seem to be abandoning that old image of being, you know, staid and boring. They're embracing more hardball tactics, a more populist tone.
And what's driving that?
It seems to be a direct response to the political chaos around Trump and also a reaction to this voter perception, especially among younger people, that the Democratic Party has become weak.
And who's the poster child for this new, more aggressive approach?
Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, the retired astronaut. He's known for being very mild-mannered, but he recently got into a very public, very profane feud with President Trump. After Kelly made a video advising military members to refuse illegal orders, Trump said he should be punished by death. Kelly's response was, let's just say not mild-mannered. He was signaling a new willingness to fight fire with fire.
So the calculation is that in this climate, perceived strength is more valuable than political decorum.
That seems to be it. They feel they need to shed that weak label by being seen as tough, not just against the right, but against the progressive wing of their own party, too, on issues like the border.
Okay, moving from aggressive politics to aggressive policy. Let's talk about California State Senator Scott Wiener, the soft-spoken, 6'7" ringleader of the YIMBY movement.
And his timing for a congressional run is perfect. Affordable housing is now at the very top of voter concerns. Wiener is the national face of the YIMBY Yes in My Backyard movement. He argues the housing crisis is caused by too much regulation and not enough building.
So his entire platform is about density, upzoning, cutting red tape.
Exactly. He's had success in California pushing state laws that override local zoning, like making it easier to build accessory dwelling units or ADUs. His supporters say he made it hip for a progressive to be pro-housing.
But the big criticism he'll face, surely, is that housing in his own backyard, the Bay Area, is still astronomically expensive.
And that's the core challenge. His opponents will ask, how can you be the guy who fixed housing when San Francisco is more expensive than ever? His allies will argue correctly that one politician can't solve a decades-long crisis overnight. But for voters, that high cost of living is a very tangible, very powerful counterargument.
It is indeed. Finally, let's pull back the curtain on a key White House power player, Deputy Chief of Staff James Blair.
Blair has become an absolutely critical, if controversial, figure. He's described as intense, fiery, and ruthlessly effective at enforcing loyalty. He's also the architect of much of the administration's political strategy. His influence on GOP redistricting was apparently so significant that some aides started calling it Blairymandering.
And how does he enforce that loyalty with members of Congress?
He's the bad cop. He delivers the tough news. They'll start a conversation with the president wants. And he frequently reminds lawmakers that Trump is more popular in their districts than they are, so they'd better get in line.
That kind of heady-handedness must create a lot of friction with Congress, which is supposed to be a co-equal branch.
It creates enormous friction, and it's reportedly a factor in why several senior Republicans are choosing to retire rather than face another term of these constant loyalty tests. But he's not just a blind enforcer. Internally, he's also the one who presents the tough data to the president, highlighting vulnerabilities and urging message discipline. He's a very effective operator.
From political strategy to economic strategy. Let's wrap this section with a look at some fascinating shifts in trade, specifically with Mexico and the chaos that's followed at the border.
It's a really remarkable story. Despite all the tariff talk, trade between the U.S. and Mexico is on track for a record year, nearly $900 billion. Mexico has successfully navigated the trade war to become our number one trading partner.
How did they manage that when China, for instance, got hit so hard?
Well, proximity and the USMCA trade deal help, but the biggest factor is the actual tariff rates. Mexico's effective tariff rate is just 4.7%. China's is 37.1%. That huge gap allowed Mexican goods to just flood in and fill the void left by more expensive Chinese products.
So Mexico is booming. But the administration's move to get tougher on all imports has created what the source calls the customs headache.
A massive headache. This all centers on the elimination of the $800 de minimis exemption back in August. For you, the listener, that rule used to let small packages valued at $800 or less come into the U.S. tariff-free without a mountain of paperwork.
And getting rid of it means every single package now needs that same level of documentation. What has that done to the system?
It's created chaos, pure chaos. You have tens of thousands of imports just blocked, sitting in warehouses, or even being destroyed because the paperwork is too complicated. FDA refusals of imports jumped 60% this fiscal year.
And the story of the vintage Jaguar part really illustrates the absurdity of it.
It's the perfect example. A guy in Dallas orders a $1,600 vintage car part from the UK seller. Customs demands to know the specific country of origin for the steel and aluminum used to make the part decades ago. Of course, no one can provide that detail, so the part was just destroyed. The consumer is now basically responsible for the entire supply chain history of every single thing they buy online from overseas. It's an impossible burden.
A system collapsing under its own weight. Okay, let's transition now to the fast-moving world of markets, business, and some pretty wild financial anomalies.
And we have to start with the runaway rally in precious metals. It's gone beyond just gold. Silver is having a truly parabolic moment. Gold is already up 72% this year, trading around $4,500 an ounce.
But silver in percentage terms is just astronomical.
It really is. Silver futures are up 164% this year, trading around $76 a troy ounce. It just smashed a 45-year record. On Friday, it had its largest one-day dollar gain in history. The market is in a frenzy.
So what's behind this? What are the fundamental drivers?
It's a perfect storm. First, you have a constrained supply. The easy-to-mine silver deposits are mostly gone. Second, you have strong industrial demand, especially from solar panel manufacturers. And third, and this is probably the biggest driver right now, is speculative fear from everyday amateur investors.
Tell me more about that motivation. It sounds less about profit and more about something else.
Mm-hmm. It's deeply psychological. You have people buying physical silver coins, bars, as a tangible hedge. They see it as insurance against inflation, against government debt, and against a digital financial system they just don't trust. They want something they can hold in their hand, store in a safe, and pass down to their kids if everything else collapses.
A rush to the tangible amid digital uncertainty. So what's the skeptics' take on this? What's the risk?
The skeptics are quick to point out that the silver market is much smaller and thinner than the gold market. That makes it prone to these massive parabolic boom and bust cycles. As one analyst put it, silver tends to be a product that goes parabolic, then collapses. So high risk, high volatility.
Okay, let's pivot from that market frenzy to a completely different kind of corporate story. The $240 million employee windfall at a company called Fiberbond in Louisiana.
This is just a wonderful counter narrative. The owner, Graham Walker, sold his family's company, Fiberbond, for $1.7 billion. And he put a non-negotiable condition in the sale. 15% of the proceeds, $240 million, had to go directly to his 540 full-time employees.
Even though they didn't own any equity in the company.
None at all. The average payout was $443,000. In a small town like Minden, Louisiana, population 12,000, that is genuinely life-changing money.
It's a massive economic injection into that community.
A seismic event. And the payout is spread over 5 years to encourage employees to stay on, which Walker felt was fair to the new owner, Eaton. He said he did it because he didn't want to run into his employees at the grocery store and feel ashamed that he hadn't shared the wealth.
And that kind of thinking seems to stem from a deep shared history at the company.
It does. The company survived a fire. The dot-com bust. During the tough times, the Walker family kept paying salaries, and that built incredible loyalty. Then the company pivoted to building infrastructure for data centers and LNG terminals, and thanks to the AI and cloud boom, sales just exploded, leading to that massive valuation.
And how are the employees using this money?
For stability and opportunity. Paying off mortgages, buying cars, funding college for their kids. One woman, Ligia Key, who started there in 1995, making $5.35 an hour, used her bonus to pay off her house and open her own clothing boutique. It's just an incredible story of shared prosperity.
It really is. Okay, let's look at another surprising shift in a different industry. The Costco in Napa Valley, becoming a go-to spot for wine lovers.
It's a fascinating development. The year-old Costco in Napa is now a hub for wine connoisseurs. And it's happening because, as the source says, there's trouble in the industry. People are flocking to Costco for the deals. You can get wines for half the price you'd pay at the winery itself.
And there's that great quote from a shopper who said, his $7 Malbec tastes better because you got a good deal.
That captures the whole shift perfectly. The old sort of lowbrow perception of buying wine at a warehouse is gone. It's been replaced by the thrill of finding value. Even Costco's own Kirkland signature label is now attracting interest from top French chateaux.
So why are the vintners who used to look down on this now so eager to sell through Costco? What's the trouble they're facing?
It's a mix of things. Younger generations are drinking less wine. There's competition from cannabis. The economy is tight. And get this, even the side effects of weight loss drugs like Ozempic, which can reduce the desire for alcohol, are having an impact. So vendors need to move product.
And the Napa Costco even has its own local celebrity, the wine steward Selman Medina.
He's become a regional star. He advises over 100 customers a day. And his secret weapon is that he can see what's in their shopping carts and suggest pairings based on the food they're actually buying for dinner that night. It's a perfect example of accessibility and value winning out over traditional ideas of luxury and scarcity.
A market shift driven by pure pragmatism.
Mm.
Okay, let's quickly run through some final corporate developments and tech predictions for 2026.
Let's start with pharma. The weight loss drug revolution is entering a new phase. Novo Nordisk got approval to sell a pill version of Wegovy and Ozempic. They're launching it in January at a discounted price of $149 a month. This move from injection to a cheaper pill signals a huge push for mass market adoption.
And in the media world, the high-stakes battle for Warner Bros. Discovery is heating up.
It is. The bid is getting more serious. Billionaire Larry Ellison has now agreed to personally guarantee over $40 billion of the financing for Paramount's offer. This is a direct response to Warner's board, who called the previous financing illusory. The personal guarantee makes it very real.
Okay, finally, what does the tech crystal ball see for 2026?
Three big things. First, Apple is finally seriously overhauling Siri. After a lot of delays, they're rebuilding it on a new architecture to properly integrate generative AI and hopefully make it much, much better.
Second, a prediction born from the rise of malicious AI, the need for proof of humanness.
Right. In 2026, the need for verified digital identity will become critical to fight off bots and fix our broken online verification systems. This means we'll see a huge acceleration in things like phone-based driver's licenses, digital passports, maybe even controversial stuff like WorldCoin's iris scanning.
And finally, more autonomous cars in more cities.
A lot more. Alphabet's Waymo is planning to open service in 5 new major cities: Miami, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, and Orlando. And Amazon Zoox is extending to Austin and Miami. It looks like autonomous vehicles are finally moving from niche testing to widespread consumer availability.
We've covered the global economy, domestic politics, the future of tech. Let's move into our final section now, where we can really unpack some of the deeper political, cultural, and philosophical reflections from this incredible stack of source material.
And we should start with a really blistering argument from former Trump lawyer Jim Trusty about the Mar-a-Lago raid. He lays out a case alleging serious government overreach and political motivation.
What's the core of his legal argument here? How does he frame the whole documents case?
He frames it as a dispute over an overdue library book. His central argument is that this entire issue should have been handled under the Presidential Records Act. And, critically, that act has no criminal penalties. He points out that every modern president has returned classified material after leaving office without facing a criminal referral, until this case.
And what specific legal tactics does he point to as evidence of, you know, politically motivated prosecution?
He cites a few highly unusual moves. First, the Biden White House waiving Trump's claim to executive privilege. Second, prosecutors using the very rare crime fraud exception to completely obliterate attorney-client privilege.
And for the listener, that exception basically says privilege doesn't apply if a lawyer's advice was used to commit a crime. It's a huge step.
A massive step. He also alleges that prosecutors threatened a key witness's lawyer, suggesting his career would be better if he got his client to flip on Trump.
And the source material also hints at a conflict inside the Justice Department itself over how to handle this.
It does. Trusty points to newly disclosed emails that suggest the FBI initially balked at escalating this to a criminal matter. They allegedly told the prosecutor, Jay Bratt, that there was no probable cause for a crime and that they should just keep cooperating to get the documents back. Trusty paints Bratt as a hell-bent prosecutor who saw his chance for glory. The whole piece really questions whether Special Counsel Jack Smith was truly independent, given the timing and the tactics used.
A viewpoint that certainly cast doubt on the process. Okay, let's move from D.C. to Tehran and look at Iran's really paradoxical strategy right now, a kind of social loosening combined with a brutal political crackdown.
It's a very complex but very calculated strategy by the regime, and it's all aimed at one thing, self-preservation. On one hand, you're seeing social freedoms not seen since 1979. Live music, women going without the mandatory hijab. But at the very same time, the government is executing people at a rate not seen in almost 40 years.
So how can those two things, which seem completely contradictory, serve the same goal?
Because the regime was badly shaken by the recent war with Israel and the ongoing economic crisis. They seem to fear that if they crack down hard on social issues, especially the hijab rules, it could trigger another massive uprising like the one after Mahsa Amini's death. So they grant social concessions that don't fundamentally threaten their grip on power.
And the political crackdown is the other side of that coin.
It's the necessary counterbalance. They use it to instill fear and crush any attempt at political organization. Executions have doubled from last year to over 1,800. They're arresting figures like the Nobel laureate Narges Mohammadi. The regime's logic seems to be, we'll let you have a little social freedom, but don't you dare challenge the system itself.
A fragile balance of a minimal release valve and maximum repression. Let's shift now to a really deep cultural reflection. This piece by Peggy Noonan that asks a fascinating question. Has America lost its melody?
It's a fantastic piece. Her thesis is that as a nation, we might still have the rhythm and the beat, you know, the constant motion, the chaos of digital life, but we've lost the melody, the actual tune, in our popular culture, and that this points to something much deeper.
And she starts with this very relatable anecdote about her own brain.
Yeah, she says that around 2005, 2010, she just stopped being able to absorb new popular music. It wouldn't stick. She thought it was just her getting older, but a young music writer gave her another theory. It's not you, it's the music. Popular musicians just stopped focusing on melody in favor of rhythm and production.
And the distinction she makes between melody and rhythm is really insightful.
It is. She says rhythm is primal, you just feel it. But melody is both thought and felt. It has two ways to get inside you, to connect. And she speculates that this cultural shift away from melody reflects the broken-upness, political and otherwise, of America itself. We've lost our shared tune.
And she sees evidence that younger people are actually hungry for that melody they're missing.
Exactly. She points to the trend of young people listening to more and more music from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They describe that older music as having a certain lilt or being charged with optimism. She suggests this is a hunger for connection. If a nation's music comes from its deepest self, she asks, what does it mean when we can't find our tune anymore?
A really profound thought. From a nation's cultural heritage to a literal family heritage, let's look at this beautiful, poignant story of a watchmaker dynasty in Nairobi.
This is a true window into history. We meet Ravinder Singh. He's 74, and he's the fifth generation in a family of watchmakers that stretches back to India in the 1800s.
And the family's history in Kenya is just incredible, defined by this kind of dual loyalty during the British colonial era.
It's amazing. His father, Vasudev, ran a successful Rolex shop that was popular with the white colonial officials. But secretly, he was using the profits from selling them luxury watches to help finance the Mau Mau insurgents who were fighting the British for independence. His shop was a clandestine meeting place to plan strategy.
So he's selling time to the colonizers while working to end their time in his country. What's the state of that legacy today?
Well, Ravinder still works in the shop on weekends, surrounded by these century-old tools. But his main living comes from a construction company. And the real issue is that his own sons aren't interested in carrying on the tradition.
The future of this five-generation legacy hangs on his grandson.
It does. His 18-year-old grandson, Harnik, is considering mechanical engineering, maybe working for a big brand like Rolex. But Ravinder is left wondering what will happen to all these irreplaceable tools and parts when he's gone. It's a really moving reflection on whether these kinds of tangible, high-skill traditions can survive in our modern digital world.
It truly is. Before we get to our final thought, let's just quickly cover a few other significant updates and opinion pieces.
First, a big moment for justice in Malaysia. Former Prime Minister Najib Razak was sentenced to another 15 years in prison for his role in the looting of the 1MDB Sovereign Wealth Fund. This is on top of a previous 12-year conviction. It's a major step for accountability and one of the biggest financial crimes of our time.
Next, a really interesting critique of a European environmental rule, which is being called a new form of colonialism by a Native American tribe.
Right. This is about the EU's deforestation-free regulation. Carla Keane, the chairman of the Kakreek band of Umpqua tribe, argues it violates their sovereignty. The rule forces them to provide highly sensitive geolocation data for all their timber harvest sites to prove they're not causing deforestation.
So a sovereign nation that's already practicing sustainable forestry is being forced to hand over sensitive data just to access the European market.
That's the problem. They argue it's the Brussels effect, where an EU rule becomes a de facto global standard. It forces them to compromise their self-governance, even though they are a model of sustainable management.
And finally, a really stark contrast in how two states are handling Medicaid fraud.
A stunning contrast. On one hand, you have Indiana, which saved $466 million just by implementing common sense reforms like better eligibility checks. On the other hand, you have Minnesota, where federal prosecutors estimate fraud losses since 2018 could top $9 billion.
$9 billion? How does it even get that bad?
Massive industrial-scale schemes. People setting up sham companies and billing for services like housing for the disabled that were never provided. Because the federal government picks up most of the Medicaid tab, states sometimes lack the incentive to police it aggressively, and you end up with systemic failures on this kind of epic scale. Indeed, that stark contrast shows the profound impact of governance and incentive alignment, whether we are talking about multi-billion dollar federal programs or the delicate balance of the global financial system.
We began this comprehensive deep dive with discussions of global conflicts and the dark arts of criminal finance. And we finished by examining systemic failures that hurt the most vulnerable Americans and the existential threat to highly skilled traditions. We've seen overwhelming macro shifts, the AI boom, the silver frenzy, the political chaos. Yet the individual search for stability remains the core narrative.
What's fascinating here is a tension between that accelerating complexity, the digital world, the $9 billion fraud, the lack of rule of law in autocratic regimes, and the deep, almost primal yearning for tangible value and connection. That search for stability manifests in different ways, in hedging against the future with physical silver, in fighting for sustainable tribal sovereignty, and in the continuation of a five-generation family watchmaking tradition.
It brings us back to the power of shared value versus guarded exclusivity. The source material today highlighted a Louisiana businessman, Graham Walker, who chose to give away $240 million to his employees, mandating shared prosperity as a condition of success. Simultaneously, we saw the Napa wine industry shifting its focus from scarcity and high price points to generating accessible quality through Selman Medina and Costco.
Both stories involve a direct choice to buck conventional extractive industry wisdom in favor of distributing unexpected value and generating local abundance.
So we leave you with this provocative thought. As the global economy grapples with centralized power structures, digital chaos, and the loss of its melody, what happens when the focus of an economy or even a political movement decides to shift its core value proposition away from traditional notions of scarcity and guarded exclusivity, and instead toward actively generating shared abundance and accessible quality? Is that profound reorientation itself the necessary foundation for the new shared tune we are all searching for?